Hello, everybody. Welcome to Podcasting Them Softly. I'm Frank speaking on a brand new microphone that my girlfriend bought me for Christmas. And I'm joined with Tim. Tim, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. And just for the people at home who can't see it, it looks like the Death Star, too, as if it wasn't already cool. That's a nice mic you got there.
I figured I don't have to talk like I'm on NPR just because I have an NPR microphone, but I figured that would be my lead-in to the episode. So, anyway, today Tim and I are not talking about Star Wars, although we are going to have a very cool one coming up. We are going to talk about Tom Ford's Nocturnal Animals, which came out this year and was only in theaters for about a week. I don't know how you saw it so late. I saw it opening weekend.
You know, it stuck around at an indie house here in Denver, and it's at a place called Chez Artiste, where some of those get longer legs. And, you know, when I saw it, I was pretty surprised. It was a pretty packed theater. It was on a Sunday afternoon, and it was not a large auditorium, but there were probably 30, 40 people there.
When I saw it, it was an old guy sitting four seats next to me and two mid-age couples. And both of the couples left midway through, and the older guy and I stuck it out, and he told me he liked it.
Both people left. That's funny. Yeah. You got walkouts on it. I mean, it's obviously it's a dark movie. Obviously, there's some violence and a couple of pretty striking, nasty images in there. But I also think with the R rating, and, you know, this isn't stuff we necessarily haven't seen before, but I don't know. Some people like to get their panties in a bunch about movies, so. Fuck him.
Right. Fuck him is right. All right, so Nocturnal Animals for me is the best film I've seen this year. There's still a couple big ones that I haven't seen. But I think it's impressive that that Nocturnal Animals, I think, is better than a Star Wars movie, a Refn movie, The Neon Demon, I think, still phenomenal, and a Malick movie, Knight of Cups. I wasn't quite sure what to expect from this movie because I had not read the source material, even though I did buy the book that's called Susan and Edward. I forgot the author. But I didn't really see much other than the two trailers that came out. I didn't read any reviews. So I was pretty much blind going into the theater when I saw it. And, of course, there are many different things we can talk about and how blown away we both were by this movie. But I think this is something that often gets forgotten about whenever I talk to somebody about this film. How about the opening credits?
The opening credits are amazing. They are absolutely amazing. And they, you know, the I guess we can talk in spoilerific terms.
Yeah,
if you're listening to this, we're going to go into spoilers. So hopefully you've seen it. But yeah, they're a very Lynchian set of slow motion shots of extremely overweight and out of shape and older women who are on pedestals with the nice almost Lynchian curtains behind them and slow mo with you know, tassels they're spinning, and they've got some not firecrackers but, you know, sparklers, and really, I mean, it's an attention grabber, obviously. You kind of can't take your eyes off it, even as you're not sure what you're seeing. I think the movie does go on to really contextualize that opening sequence nicely. What are your thoughts on what he's trying to do with those?
I think one thing you left out, and if I'm remembering correctly, is these women were overly patriotic with their dressing and the accessories they had.
Pretty much
is a cynical-ish representation of America. Overweight people waving the American flag. As far as how it relates to the rest of the film, well, that is Amy Adams' character, Susan. That's her art opening, right? She's the curator of sorts. I don't know if that's actually her job, but right, she's the curator of this gallery. I don't know if
Yeah, she runs the art gallery where this is a new installation, which I found it really funny, too. I'm like, how do you run an installation like that, you know, for regular business hours for 3 months or however long it's going to go? I have a feeling the models might get a little tired. But anyway.
I think that as you learn more from the film, Amy Adams' character stopped pursuing art. And she went into, management or curation, essentially where the money was. Where she's going to get paid a ton of money to bring in different exhibits to draw people in. I think that there are many different ways to look at the opening credits. I looked at that in regards to the film as very degrading and debasing. Self-degradation and debasing. And I think that is what Amy Adams continuously does to herself throughout the film, because she deserves it and she knows she deserves it, but also because I think it got to a point where she really doesn't know any other way. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Absolutely. You know, just to back up to piggyback on what you originally said about America, it's kind of her journey in trying to achieve the American dream. You could look at it that way, because like you said, she chooses money over art. Yeah. She gives up on art. She turns into her mother, as her mother warns her she will. She ends up leaving. And I think those models at the beginning are a great visual representation of that, of kind of the corruption of the American dream that we see her go through as we learn her story.
I don't necessarily know if it's the corruption of the American dream. Excuse me. I know, but think about it this way. She chooses money over passion twice. I mean, she chooses to ditch art because it's too hard. I'm not talented. I'm just going to give up because it's just easier to get a degree in art, finance, or business, or whatever that made up degree probably is to, you know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
And then she also does it by ditching Jake Gyllenhaal for Armie Hammer, because Armie Hammer, first of all, looks like Captain America. Secondly, he's rich, assuming so in the movie. And thirdly, it's just going to be an easy, boring, perhaps hollow. It's just
The path of least resistance is what she chooses, which is, it's funny though, because early on, like her first scene with Hammer, it's very clear that the romance is just about dead. It's no shock at all when you see he's banging someone back in New York, and he indicates that they are not in good financial shape. They've probably got that churn and burn going where they're trying to make it look as if they are still on top of the world, but they are not. So really, you know, romantically, it hasn't worked out, and financially, it's not working out either. So I think you get an indication. All of this indicates to you early on that she has not made good choices.
Yeah. And you know what? Not to segue too much off, but did you think that this may just be me nitpicking? Do you think it looked I don't know what I'm trying to articulate. Do you think that Armie Hammer and Amy Adams looked age appropriate together in the present day? It's Armie Hammer. He's probably like 35, maybe 40. I don't know. I don't think so. I was just curious about that.
It didn't trip me up. And I'm trying to think now that I go back and look, I'm trying to think of how long of a gap we are given between when they got together and she had the
years.
All that. It is 20 years.
Well, about so, because they have a daughter in college, Armie Hammer.
No, that's true.
Adams
they have their
in college.
That's absolutely right. They have that college-age daughter.
But anyway, aside from that, it's just a very heavy and richly layered film. Now, I guess I don't even know how to approach this other than give some sort of brief synopsis or whatever your and I interpretation is of the film, which I think you and I are pretty much in lockstep of.
Well, I will say I see it as a great revenge film.
Oh, without a doubt.
I think it's one of the best revenge films. It's funny, I was thinking about it earlier today, about how, you know, kind of the main revenge guy working today is Tarantino. He's obsessed with revenge. All of his films boil down to revenge one way or another. But they tend to, while a lot of the trappings are really fun, they tend to be a little disposable. You know, there's not a huge emotional attachment in say, Kill Bill. Not that it's not a really fun set of movies, but there's
yourself,
okay,
but
that's
know,
fair.
But,
that's
I,
fair.
But I know what you're saying.
It's a little more cartoony, and yes. This one does such a fascinating job of playing with fiction as a tool to bring out. And there's obviously multiple levels. There's the book, there's the movie within which, you know, the book exists, and then there's us, the viewer. But if you call the movie itself your baseline layer of reality, to see this work of fiction do so much, reflect so much that's happened in their real world and do so much damage to her in her real world, I think it's a fascinating kind of testament to the power of fiction when done well. And obviously he's geared a lot of this story towards her. I love the idea of him reimagining their whole story as this, you know, basically Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I spit on your grave, awful set of circumstances that's happened.
Yeah, it's very blood simple.
They're very blood simple. I mean, there's a list, you know.
Yeah, it's a dusty noir. The second
very
layer.
Much so.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think there are three layers to the film, like you brought up, but even more so in a little bit, there's present day of Amy Adams reading the novel that Jake Gyllenhaal drops off to her. There is her, which I want to get into. There is the novel itself, and then there's the flashbacks. And each of these three time periods are simultaneously cross-cut together to not only help develop the story, but I really think help pitch the ending, which I know we're going to get to because I know we really, really want to talk about it. And I agree with you. I think this is one of the best revenge films ever. I think revenge is very cinematic, and especially when done. I mean, this is a noir film in its own way. I mean, it's De Palma-y noir. I mean, there's no like knives and blood, except for there are certain parts. Okay, so anyway, this is what I want to ask you. Okay, so we have present day of Amy Adams reading the novel that Jake Gyllenhaal drops off, dedicated to her, called Nocturnal Animals, what he called her. Mm-hmm. Now there's the novel, where we only see Jake Gyllenhaal predominantly in the novel, a little bit in the flashbacks, but most of his screen time is the novel. Now, when we're seeing the novel, whose imagination is that? Is that her imagination, or is that his imagination? Does that make sense to you?
I think it's a beautiful confluence of both. I think that's one of the kind of the wonderful things about it is that, yes, you're cutting back to her enough that it's obviously her reading experience. At the same time, it's all his imagination because he wrote the damn thing. And you point out, it's interesting to me too, that his real world character, you know, that she left and everything, Tony Hastings, I think. Or no, Tony Hastings is in the book. Edward is his actual character. But you really get to know him through Tony. His real journey in front of our eyes is, you know, in the novel. Because he's really, he seems like a nice enough guy, but you really don't spend that much time with him. And he does, you know, the whole kind of, he's not man enough, you know, he doesn't put that much of an impression on you in his dealings in the flashbacks with Adams. And then you see him kind of devolve into a kind of rote revenge machine in the film, which comes to, you know, a violent end. And then you see it actually happen, but almost off camera, because that's clearly what he's done, is turned into a revenge machine in the real world, but he's done it through art. And ultimately is the victor, you know, when in that final scene, he doesn't show up. He's said his piece, he's done what he needed to do. And I'm sorry, I've gotten way off track of your original question.
It's all good.
But yeah, that whole, just kind of the paralleling that's going on, and using the genre tropes. It's funny because if you look at the story of the book, it's very cut and dried. It's not hugely, you know, there's no twist to it. Man has terrible night, loses family, goes, gets revenge, dies, the end. But then in tandem with what you are told, the way it just opens up every scene, I mean, I'm kind of kicking myself I didn't rewatch it before we talked about this, because I've got to think that so many little bits, I mean, you could feel it when you're learning what's going on for the first time, but I've got to think there's so many things that are going to really stick out on second viewing that just interlace so nicely with what really happened to their relationship.
I think Tom Ford's just this cinematic anomaly who has just become this auteur that's self-made. He makes A Single Man, 2009, waits this long to make Nocturnal Animals. The guy has no business making film. The guy has no formal... Geez, I don't want to say this word because it's going to sound dumb, but like training or experience in film and directing and writing. The guy comes from the fashion industry, completely saves Gucci. Now he has his own brand that everybody knows, Tom Ford. His movies do not look like anybody else's movies. And this is my really long-winded way of saying he's a genius. But what I specifically want to talk about with his genius is casting. Particular with casting is... You say that the story within a story is just cut and dry. I agree with you. It's like, this happens, this happens, this happens. There's no character development whatsoever. I mean, we know they're traveling to wherever they're traveling. They run into the pack of assholes. Shit just gets real. Now, Michael Shannon gives his best performance I've ever seen the guy give, and that guy's fucking amazing in everything. Aaron Taylor Johnson, who just won the Best Supporting Golden Globe for this role, which I was really surprised he won because this film has kind of become swept under the rug as the awards season campaign has picked up.
It has.
Look what these two guys, along with Gyllenhaal, did with just one-note characters. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, Michael Shannon's just the detective. I mean, he's just supposed to be the detective that is dying of cancer that wants to help out Jake Gyllenhaal. But I mean, look at how interesting and unique and complex these characters are without giving us anything. I mean, all we're doing is reacting to their performances, which I think is very striking considering these characters are just one note throwaway characters.
They are. And I think you're absolutely right about the casting, that the all three of those actors give great performances in this, and that does elevate the material. If they were not as strong, then it may not have worked as well. But the Michael Shannon character, I really love, because not again because you haven't seen him a million times, because of course you've seen the grizzled cop trying to solve one last case.
Jeff Bridges in Hell or High Water is this comparable character this year.
Sure.
Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, Tommy Lee Jones, No Country for Old Men, the list goes on. There's a million of them. But what I really like about him is that he's like the Pied Piper. He is dragging, you know, he won't let the case go. And I'm sure Gyllenhaal, of course, he isn't going to either. He lost his wife and his daughter. But Shannon fades. He disappears. And you may note he kind of wanders off at the end. He almost becomes a ghost and almost inhabits Gyllenhaal by the end. I felt like those characters were just merging throughout the book, the book within the movie. And that at the end, really... He's a shade. He's a ghost. He's just about dead. He can't do it. He has left Gyllenhaal with the tools. He has led him to this point. He's got him all lined up for the turkey shoot, and he's gone. And you don't see him. You don't see him get shot. You don't see him keel over and die. He's kind of served his purpose, and he has dragged Gyllenhaal basically into becoming him, a guy who is focused on nothing else but this case and this terrible thing and getting physical revenge. And I thought that was really interesting. I kind of felt he was almost almost a ghost, you know, almost like one of those characters that you would see in another movie, the Sixth Sense trick, where if you went back and looked, nobody else talks to him all along, right. except for, and I know that's not the case, but he kind of felt in that vein to me, almost this ghostly spirit of revenge that's just imbuing Gyllenhaal more and more as the story goes on, until he gets to that point where he's like, all right, you're ready, kid. You've got the gun. You're fighting for your life. You're ready to be a man, you know, and he's out. And I thought that was really cool.
I also thought the symbolism in this film was very fierce and striking. Both heavy-handed and not so heavy-handed at times. I think the opening credits is a bit of a heavy-handed swipe, and I think it works perfectly, because by the time the movie's over, you don't even remember what the fuck the opening credits are. You know what I mean?
It took me a second when you asked me about it. And I was like, oh, shit. Yeah.
You're sitting in the theater and you see the opening credits and you're like, I'm not going to forget this. And then by the end of the movie, it's just like I'm emotionally devastated. And I messaged somebody right after I saw it and they're like, how about those opening credits? And I'm like, what opening credits?
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
you're on such a journey at that point. You've been through so much. Yeah.
Right. But I also love how the red sofa was something I didn't pick up on the first time I saw it. Now, the red sofa within the novel, where his wife's body, where his wife and daughter's bodies are found in that shanty or wherever, that hellhole in Texas, is the same red sofa that Amy Adams is sitting on when her and Jake Gyllenhaal are having that conversation in the flashback about how he's not that good of a writer and he needs to stop writing about himself. And it was her critique of what he gave her to read that he just wrote. And like anybody who's given their significant other something that they have spent a long time creating, and then that significant other becomes a little critical, Jake Gyllenhaal becomes, you know, very defensive of himself, because this is his whole life. This is everything that he's working on are on these pages. And it's not so much that Amy Adams is being critical. She's really being a bitch about it. I mean, we'll be honest. I mean, she's telling him that, you know, maybe you should start thinking about teaching and, you know, you need to stop writing about yourself.
Maybe you should get a real job and grow up. Yes,
right,
they're having
right.
one of those conversations.
She is sitting on that same red sofa where within the novel, Tony's wife and daughter are found. So when their love died, Jake Gyllenhaal and Amy Adams, she was sitting on that red sofa.
That's a great catch. And it makes you wonder, you know, and I'd like to go back and see the scene where Adams is reacting to that scene, not only, you know, because the first thing you think is, well, of course, it's terrible because they're dead and they relate to people, you know, to real people, her being one of them. But you kind of wonder if she's reading a description of the red sofa, you know, if that's stuck, then that scene is stuck with her. And if that's what's really the gut punch there is because, you know, funny enough, those pieces of furniture, they almost become part of the family. And when you're together as a couple, the things that you have together, you know, they have some import. You spend a lot of time, you know, with your lover on these things. So that's a good catch. I did not realize that. That's pretty spectacular. I mean, speaking of symbolism, obviously the symbolism of taking the, you know, redneck murder scenario as a genre and slapping that onto a dead romance and a romance where, you know, obviously to really stick the knife in, she had an abortion without telling him. I think that right there is just kind of a wonderful layering and a good symbolic direction to go in. But I don't know if I've seen that before necessarily. I mean, I think of like Lost Highway maybe, because there's obviously a dying romance there that's kind of symbolically recast as a little more of a noir story and things like that. But I haven't seen it done often, and I haven't seen it done as well, I think, as it is here.
I can't believe the story. Now, I'm so very curious to read the novel. But I would imagine that the novel is quite a bit different than the film, because I read A Single Man after I saw the film, and there was quite a bit different within the film than the novel. But the story is just, is so big. They break up. She has an abortion. Armie Hammer's there to console her. She doesn't tell Jake Gyllenhaal, but no. He's there watching in the fucking rain, which is the best shot of the movie, I think. Is
a lovely shot, yeah.
standing in the rain. He doesn't say anything, doesn't do anything dramatic. He just stands there and leaves. Then for Jake Gyllenhaal to spend 20 years writing a novel where he is, you know, killing her, killing their unborn kid, and her reacting in this almost positive, remorseful way to where everything in her life is so shitty, that seeing Jake Gyllenhaal after 20 years is the best possible thing she could do. And then she goes to meet him, like, all excited. Like, she put lipstick on, wipes the lipstick off. She looks hot. She's just sitting there. And then for him not to show up, I think, is just the most pulverizing ending I have ever seen in a movie, man. It's so fucking slight.
You know what's... Yeah, no, I agree. And what's funny to me is that this is actually, if you think about it, the second movie this year that has ended with almost the exact same thing happening. You saw The Lobster, right?
Yeah, I actually just watched The Lobster.
The Lobster. So, you know, the movies couldn't have... less to do with each other, but there's that, you know, there's that bit where Colin Farrell, you know, she's asked him to come be with her, and he just can't do it. He can't do it and doesn't show up. And anyway, it reminded me of that, although I think this one, that movie is such a highly stylized, strange movie, it almost blunts its emotional impact. This one is a lot more grounded, and it's grounded, not necessarily that it's not, you know, fantasy, but it's grounded in that it mirrors things we've seen in other genre movies before. It mirrors things we've seen in romance movies. It mirrors things we've seen in thrillers, and it's, you know, obviously it's playing with all of those things. But yeah, that, I mean, she is ready to make things right, clearly. She feels like, oh my gosh, he was the great artist. This novel is devastating and wonderful, as she says. I clearly picked the wrong horse with Armie Hammer, who's out in New York City with his girlfriend in the elevator. I thought that was nicely handled. And you know, she wants to make things right, and he's not going to give that to her. No, you don't get it. It didn't literally kill him, obviously, because he's still bouncing around. But his death at the end of his novel feels very appropriate in that all hope is lost for them, you know, and has been for a long time. That's how it happened in the real world, and that's how it has to happen in the novel. And there's not going to be a happy ending after you pull what she pulled. And, yeah, it is great. I love how it lingers, how the camera just lingers for a while, and she has a drink. And she has another drink. On her third, I think, when they finally cut to credits, and they're messing with you, the viewer, too, obviously. But as soon as she sat down and had that drink and no one was there, I was like, we're not going to see him. He said goodbye in the novel. We saw his death scene in the novel. It's like he's almost literally not available to show up. But, you know, it was obviously just all part of his plan. But I think his plan is worked to perfection. And yeah, that ending is, I don't know. There were a couple sniffles in the auditorium that I saw it in. I think it really got to people. And I didn't have a bunch of walkouts. I did have a bunch of, it was an older crowd, but they all seemed pretty well up for it and pretty well into it.
There's two things I wanted to say. Yeah. I think that the ending to his novel is just brilliant. Because I mean, I think the whole thing, what essentially the film is trying to say in its own way, that when you are in a very passionate and very in tune relationship with somebody, and then all of a sudden it's over, it's going to feel like death to one of those two people. And I mean, of course it doesn't feel like death because you have no idea what death feels like, but this is what you think the closest thing to death is ever going to be, aside from dying, is when something so catastrophic happens to your life. And I think that he perfectly shores that up with the end of his novel, because he kills himself accidentally and it's over. And the pain is just over, and it's so much to watch and it's so much to take in. And the second thing I was going to say is I want to rewatch the film again, but I think he's watching her at the restaurant at the end.
Think so?
I don't know if he's there the whole time, but I think he's there to see if she shows up, and then he may leave. But I mean, yeah, I mean, the only time you see him in present day is when he drives up in the same Mercedes that's in the past, that's in the novel, that old whatever Mercedes, and drops the novel off in her mailbox and leaves. And you don't even see him then, but you know that's Jake Gyllenhaal.
Mm-hmm.
And then him emailing her back. I mean, there's nothing, and I think that's great. And the interesting thing is, a couple people thought that the novel is all in her head and Jake Gyllenhaal doesn't exist. I've had a couple people say that to me, and it's like, yeah, no. Because she's waiting at the end of the movie for somebody to show up that isn't there. And it's like, yeah, no, man.
It wouldn't
make sense then.
I've had some interesting conversations about this film with, quite frankly, some people who just didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them made the point, it was like, it totally didn't work because you don't get to see the final showdown. And it's like, dipshit, the whole movie is the final showdown. The whole – her reading the book, that's what that's the revenge. That's the plot. That's what he has planned out, and he executes it exactly as he's envisioned it. And not as she would have it, or anyone else for that matter. But the whole time she's reading that book, that's him getting his final digs in on her. They to have just about any kind of scene of them coming together at the end would really rob the film. I mean, even if he came in and said, ha ha, I don't want to see you anymore, and walked out, you know, something a little more eloquently written than that. But you know what I mean? Even if it was something like that, it wouldn't have half the devastating impact of him clearly standing her up, clearly having messed with her.
The fact we don't see him is what makes it so powerful.
Exactly. It's much more of a gut punch. And like I said, you see his final scene. He is, for all intents and purposes, dead at that point. And yeah, I mean, I think you can get crazy with theories if you want, but really I think that's probably more for like the film I mentioned before, Lost Highway, than right. This one. I don't think there's that many more meta layers to be peeled off here. There's enough that they're playing with the novel being represented inside the movie. I don't think they're going for anything crazier than that. I would say too, an interesting thing is I don't think Gyllenhaal lets himself off the hook for perhaps his maybe being a little more ineffectual than he should have been within the confines of their relationship. Because, you know, he lets his wife and daughter go
right
to the redneck group at the beginning. I think he's kicking himself a little bit too. I think there's a little bit of two to tango there that he his behavior played into the demise of his relationship with Adams early on. It's symbolically represented by him not stepping up and doing more to protect his wife and his daughter. And so while I think obviously what she has done to him is terrible, especially with the aborting their child without telling him, I do think that within the confines of his overall story and his narrative, I think that's a piece of it. And that also plays again into there's a lot of examining of masculinity and tough guy stuff going on throughout that. Handled well between those three prime actors that we talked about earlier.
I certainly think that he holds himself accountable for letting Amy Adams, you know, walk out of his life. Maybe not letting her, but the fact that he probably didn't fight for her as much as he should have or wanted to. And I think that's a perfect representation of, you know, him letting the fucking hillbillies take his wife and daughter away. I mean, you know it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, as soon as, like, they get pulled over or run off the road, you know exactly what's going to happen. I mean, not to the degree, but, I mean, not every... You know what I mean? You know exactly.
You don't know every story beat, but you've seen this story before.
You know it's going to end very badly.
And as we were talking about earlier, if that was the whole movie... If you took out everything else, if you did a crazy director's cut and just called it the it was just the book that he wrote and nothing else, it wouldn't be very good. It wouldn't get very well reviewed. It wouldn't be something that people would be doing podcasts on. You know, it'd just be like, well, that's a pretty by the numbers revenge thriller.
Yeah, it's a dusty noir.
Mm-hmm. But in, you know, taken in tandem, obviously, with the overall framing of it, couldn't be used better. Yeah, it's really great movie. I hope it gets some Academy love, and I don't know exactly when the nominations come out for the Academy Awards.
I think it's going to certainly get either Michael Shannon or Aaron Taylor Johnson are going to get nominated for it. I think Seamus McGarvey is going to get who we were. He was a guest way back when we had Seamus on right as he was going into production on Nocturnal Animals. Fuck.
Is that right?
That was a while ago. Yeah. So I think he'll probably get nominated. I think it's going to get nominated up the ass for like score, art direction, costumes, maybe. And then I also think that I don't think he's going to get nominated, even though I think he should. I don't think it's going to get a Best Picture nomination, but I think he'll get nominated for screenplay, for adapted screenplay.
Yeah, that could be. It's a tough year, you know.
I don't know if it's there's a tough a lot of a competition. Year, man.
There, but I mean, there's just a lot more attention on it. It all, you know, it all goes back to attention.
Scorsese's movie like evaporated. Michael Keaton's movie evaporated. Keaton was supposed to win Best Actor a year ago, and then the founder got all fucked up, and the release date got moved around like six times, and nobody has seen it except for, you know, special screenings or critic screenings, I think, to get the movie out.
Just to get it eligible, yeah.
But, you know, and then I'll tell you what, man, I'm gonna fucking throw a rager shit fit by myself in my place when Deadpool gets a nomination for Best Picture over something like Nocturnal Animals, or, geez, I don't know, A Bigger Splash, or The Lobster, or, I mean, I get that movies like The Lobster aren't going to get nominated, but, and I don't want this conversation to digress too much. All I'm going to say is Deadpool is a fun movie.
It is. It is not an Academy Award caliber movie. And I know they, you know, when they originally opened up the category to as many or as few nominees as you want, that was a direct response to The Dark Knight not being nominated for Best Picture, because The Dark Knight should have been maybe it didn't need to win. I forget who it was up against, but it should have been nominated for Best Picture. It was just that damn good. So I get why you're worried that here, 8-9 years later, that now it's become so open, and comic book movies have become so ubiquitous too in the culture, that the Deadpool would sneak in. I don't think it's going to get nominated, though. I think
it's got two big guild nominations behind it.
It does.
It's going to get some major nomination. It's either going to be screenplay or something. It's either going to be picture or screenplay.
I think Best Original Screenplay is a real possibility. Just for a nomination, I still don't think it would win, considering what its competition is going to be. No, I mean,
it'll be adapted screenplay. No, and it would either lose to, probably Fences is probably going to win adapted screenplay, would be my guess. But
yeah, you said that was really good.
That is amazing. But, yeah, so anyway, it's just going to piss me off that they're going to do like fucking 8 nominations out of 10, and Deadpool is going to be there, Nocturnal Animals isn't going to get nominated. But anyway, I do think that it is picking up a little bit more steam, because it got nominated for like 9 BAFTAs, including Best Director, Picture, Actor, Jake Gyllenhaal.
It did. The BAFTAs were very kind to it, and obviously with Johnson winning the Golden Globe, that was a big help. Because I don't think at that point it was really on a lot of people's radar, because you said, it came and went. It was a come and go kind of, like so many other good movies do anymore. sadly, you know, they just don't have the legs. Box office in general doesn't have the legs it used to, and these smaller films really struggle sometimes. Sometimes they hit a vein and all of a sudden you got a sleeper hit, but more often than not, I think a lot of people choose to stay home, which is too bad, because this is, you know, I'll just put in my little plug for the theater experience in general. This is well worth seeing on a big screen.
Oh, yeah.
With a nice sound system. It does have a beautiful cinematography by McGarvey. It has a gorgeous score. And I was coming back to the score. You mentioned De Palma earlier. I love the scenes of Amy Adams kind of mulling over the novel as she's reading it throughout the movie in this big, you know, beautiful but empty and increasingly cold feeling house that she's in. I thought that was very De Palma. There was a very "There's Trouble on the Horizon" kind of operatic sweep to the score, and just the shots and the fades that they were doing felt very De Palma to me in a good way.
Yeah, Abel Korenzowski, I think is his name, his last name, how you pronounce it. His score, he did the score for A Single Man too. I'm not too familiar with him outside of the two Tom Ford pictures. I think he did the score for Penny Dreadful, but I'm not sure. Even though we're both sitting in front of computers and can find out. Or anybody listening can also Google that. His scores are... Jesus, man. They are cinematic-sounding music. I mean, it is just this very heartfelt, slow burn of a song that sounds like there is a shadow of an axe over everything, and you are just patiently waiting for the bottom to fall out of everything.
That's a fantastic way to put it. Just under the shadow of the axe.
Right.
I love it. Uh-huh. You are absolutely right, by the way. Penny Dreadful is probably his biggest credit outside of the two Tom Fords. Yes.
Yeah.
He's got a variety of other things, but I think he's done, I believe he is from Poland, and I think a fair amount of what he has done probably hasn't had a lot of audience over here. Yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah, perhaps if he's been in the fashion world as long as he has, I'm sure he's probably bumping into a lot of people from all around the planet. But right. But it's a good collaboration, very good collaboration, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you think we've covered this one well? Any other closing?
I think
comments?
So. No.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to discuss anything else unless you would like to bring anything up.
You know, I think I've hit my major points. I just say to anyone listening, if you haven't seen the film, why are you listening? We just spoiled the whole damn thing for you. But really, if you haven't seen the film, by all means, see it. There's still plenty of surprises. You still haven't seen the interesting place that a toilet occupies. I mean, there's many little treats to be had.
Yes. Also, the score came out on vinyl on the 13th of January.
If
anybody wants to pick it up on vinyl, it is out, which I most certainly am going to.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I'll put that on my list pretty quick. Excellent.